Welcome to Nerds Amalgamated, a podcast that covers the latest events in science, pop culture, and gaming.
I'm the professor, aspiring game developer, sci-fi aficionado, and completely and undeniably a geek trying to take over the world. I'll be breaking down the news from tech to gaming.
I am the DJ, a humble nerd, a big weeb,
and a watcher from the halls of the multiverse.
Just kidding. Anyways, I'll be breaking down all things comics to movies to anime.
Join us and stay hydrated as we quench you with witty banter, unintentionally hilarious hot takes, and trivia more fun than a night at the pub, courtesy of Nerds Amalgamated. Welcome back to another episode of Nerds Amalgamated. We've got another great show this week. We're talking about the Voyager data fix to repair the spaceship that is the furthest from Earth, the ESA's take on game preservation, and using Rotten Tomatoes statistics to fire your directors.
Sure, that will end or not.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, and that extra voice is our guest, BPM.
Hello, everybody, again.
So our first topic for tonight, the Voyager repair. How do you repair a spaceship which is nearly a light day away from Earth?
No machines.
Build a bigger, faster rocket. One with just blackjack and hookers.
All right, Bender. That's actually harder than it would sound, especially because the Voyager spacecraft took advantage of a particular lineup of the planets to be able to gravity sling themselves out of the solar system.
Maybe they could bounce AI electrical waves through space to try and repair it. Not that advanced yet, or are we? That is the.
Of course, we just ask our alien pals to stop in on the way past.
going to ET and go, hey ET, while you're phoning home, can you tell your home planet that we've got a satellite near your vicinity to fix up that satellite there?
Well, the Voyager probes are also the ones with the golden record, which happens to include a map to Earth and pictures of delicious, delicious humans. So I'm not sure we want the aliens to find that one.
Depends on the aliens.
So back in November, the Voyager 1 space probe stopped responding and was providing garbled data. A few weeks ago, the team at JPL managed to download all of the memory from the computer using what they call a poke command. The poke command caused the computer to read out all of the data in memory and beam it back to Earth. Looking at that readout, they realized that 3% of the memory of the FDS, the flight data subsystem, was corrupt and could not be repaired. So because you obviously can't just send a guy out there with a soldering iron to fix it, they've had to work around it by breaking up the code that was stored on that part of the memory and putting it into different areas on the RAM. But to do that, you then have to go and check all of the references to that memory and make sure that that is correct. And unfortunately, they haven't yet fixed the science capabilities of the space probe, only the engineering data. So it's able to phone home and say, hey, I'm still here. But we're not actually collecting any science data yet.
Oh, that's going to suck.
Yeah, it can't record anything. So any aliens that happen to have gone past in the past couple of months, we've missed that.
Oh, that sucks.
Unless they've installed alien malware that's sending it back to NASA and then we've got to get assaulted by them. You never know.
Oh, yeah, like the opposite of Independence Day.
Yep.
Okay. All we need now is Jeff Goldblum and Will Smith to actually come in and save the day.
What, Will Smith by slapping someone?
Yeah, that will go down well. Hi, I come in peace. Wait, hold up. Before I come in peace, wham!
That's how we say hello back on Earth.
And the other problem, Voyager's 22 and a half light hours away from Earth. So it takes almost a full day for a radio signal to reach it, and then another full day for the response to come back.
What's even weirder for me is how, like, imagine trying to be NASA and you go through paperwork after paperwork of manuals and all that just to try and figure out how the hell do you fix a 46-year-old computer system. Like, I bet the user manual must have been a shelf high.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing about how they actually fix this in more detail. Because yeah. Ultimately, they have to pull in someone who has been around since the 70s. Is it well documented enough that they have the shelves of documentation?
Or they use an alien tech that they don't release, haven't released to the public yet.
Watch out when you say that, BPM. Apple might hear this and they go, okay, we want advantage of that lovely, lovely tech.
Good luck hacking into NASA. They're not that good.
Well, it's obvious Apple iPhones were already made with alien tech. That's why they had the problem when people were holding it wrong.
and holding it too close to the ear, influencing cancer in the brain.
So one of
the rumors said.
Like, obviously, the problem is that they designed it for alien hands.
Well, aliens with no hands, they just use telepathic engine. No, like, you know, psychic swipe left, swipe right.
And then social media came into being and destroyed any remnants of good tech from Apple.
Let's be honest, Apple hasn't made good tech since Wozniak left.
Yeah. But I would say this, though, with the Voyager data fix, it's quite an achievement just to get the computers in the satellite running after all these years.
Yeah, it's incredible that it's still actually functioning with effectively no maintenance. Obviously, they've got remote access to it so they can upload new code and stuff, but there's no one up there clearing out the dust.
Maybe that just cleans itself.
How long do you reckon it will take for a human being to go, okay, you know what, we're going to dust off the cobwebs from Voyager 1 and we're going to add in some new drives and new scientific equipment up there? How long will it take for that to happen?
When light speed exists.
Are you talking about people going to Voyager and upgrading the hardware on Voyager? Or are you talking about launching a new spacecraft?
Well, a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. But let's entertain the thought, though. Like, imagine they send someone up there.
Basically, the entire universe is working against that happening.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
Matter of orbital mechanics.
Yeah.
But you have to find a trajectory where you could launch a spaceship on exactly the right path to catch up with Voyager, somehow accelerate it fast enough to catch up with Voyager, slow it down when it gets to Voyager, dock with Voyager, conduct the repairs, and then, assuming it's a manned spacecraft, bring them home, which is another problem in itself.
So how long is it?
More of an easier route and just create a data clean that can reach the distancing.
So how long will it take, you reckon, Professor? Like, let's say if all things are possible in the perfect world.
If for some reason they decided they absolutely needed to pick up Voyager and bring it home, I'm not sure it could be done with what I know of current rocket technology.
10 billion years, maybe.
How long is one light year? So one light year in kilometers is 9.46 to the power of 12. That's 9.5 Sorry.
A bit less than a light day away, so 1/365th of that.
Okay, so it will take him, in years-wise, it will take him, it doesn't give an accurate measurement. Oh, here we go. How long does it take to go one light year? About 17,500 years just to reach one light year.
Yeah, but it's only one light day away.
Yeah.
The difficulty is the hardest part is going to be lining up a trajectory and accelerating to a speed that lets you catch up with it. This has got me really interested in learning more about how the computers on the Voyager work, because I've read about things like the Long Now project in the past, where they want to create a computer that will last 100 years with no maintenance. Well, this is already halfway there.
So what's taking the other half away then?
That it just hasn't been tested.
Of course. It's always experimental.
It's only been out there for 46 years.
That's true.
So is it ready to last another 50 years out there?
No, probably not. Probably degrade probably another, I'm just going to guess here, maybe another 20 years?
Yeah. Unfortunately, out in space where there's no shielding from cosmic rays.
Or dark holes, or black holes.
Yeah, that would be unlucky.
Oh, yeah.
Or supernovas. But,
cosmic rays cause damage to computer equipment. So
and not to mention solar flares as well.
Yeah, less of an issue the further away from the sun you get.
Yeah, that's true.
Unless they find another sun.
Yeah, that too.
But we won't be able to record it because the science thing doesn't work.
I'm also reading the article and it's saying that Australia had a vital role in the search for the Voyager 2 after the signals were lost.
How so?
They said they were the Canberra's deep space communication complex that were monitoring for signals and then sending a successful command to shift the spacecraft's antenna 2 degrees.
I think you're thinking of a different issue. Last year, there was a Voyager 2 issue where the antenna became unaligned, so they had to find a way to communicate with it and tell it to point its way back to Earth. So it's a different spaceship, but I wouldn't be entirely surprised to hear that the Deep Space Communication Network station in Canberra is working on the Voyager 1 project as well.
Could just call them up and ask, maybe.
We probably could. Astronomers tend to be fairly friendly people, in my experience.
Are we talking just Dr. Carl here, or someone else are you thinking about?
No, I'd probably start with Paul Watson.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
He's an astronomer, so he's obviously much closer to the nitty-gritty there than Dr. Carl is.
Wait, Paul Watson as in the guy who started the Sea Shepherd thing movement? That Paul Watson?
No.
Okay. Wrong Paul Watson.
I'm trying to find a reference for him. I can't actually find one for who he was. But there was I think he was British, and he traveled to Australia to work at the Siding Springs Observatory.
Okay.
Sorry, Fred Watson, not Paul Watson. That's what I've got wrong.
Okay. Yeah, Fred Watson. Okay. So how long do you reckon before AI comes in and takes over the role of what NASA did? You reckon it'll be instantaneous, or you reckon it will...
I think what NASA does is too specialized to have what we currently call AI do it.
It'll probably weave its way in eventually, like everything else.
What's also what this also highlights is the fact that long distance communication can be, like, even further from Earth can be doable in essence.
Yeah, and it's going to be a sad day when eventually the Voyager craft lose contact. And whether that's because they're simply out of range of current technology or because they are damaged beyond repair, they are the furthest human-made objects from Earth and are picking up data about all sorts of interesting stuff.
You reckon the James Webb satellite could take its place?
No.
No?
They're different things entirely.
Okay.
So James Webb is an infrared telescope. The Voyager was a visible light telescope, and it was sent to take photos of a couple of planets on its way out of the solar system.
It says here for the Voyager that unlike Voyager's other instruments, the operation of a camera for visible light is not autonomous, but is controlled by an imaging parameter table contained in one of the digital computers. The Flight Data Subsystem, also known as FDS. Since the 1990s, most space probes have been equipped with completely autonomous cameras. I don't know whether that answers your question or...
Yeah, so it's a visible light probe. So moving on, our next topic is about the ESA and their opinion on video game preservation.
Oh, that's not that's not going to sound good.
You mean like archiving it in a library or something? Or
yeah. So the ESA is the Entertainment Software Association, and the United States Library of Congress Copyright Office held a hearing to evaluate a copyright exemption for accessing video games for video game researchers. And the lawyer representing the ESA, Steve England, was asked about whether libraries would be able to do that. And he said there is basically absolutely no chance that ESA members would support that.
Wait. Before you continue, there are video game researchers?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that shouldn't surprise you.
a video game researcher? I mean, what? There are people that can do that?
Yeah.
Why have I not heard this? I want to be a video game researcher now.
Of course people study fine art.
A is saying they don't want games to be archived for research, or are they saying something else entirely?
Their big deal was that they don't want it done because they're worried it would infringe on their copyright. But at the same time, we also have no problem preserving works of literature in libraries.
Mm.
So why not software?
It comes down to the fact that, when you're copywriting a game, you're also, it's the game developer's work of art. So optically, there should be grounds to archive it.
Yeah.
But for the ESA to go, nah, we're not going to archive any of these games. Spits in the face of what game preservation is all about.
And they've made no attempt to meet the researchers halfway.
So what were the researchers' demands, essentially? Well, not really demands, but what were their, what did they want?
The researchers were requesting for libraries to be able to preserve video games and make them available for access.
Okay, that sounds
reasonable. Particularly remote access.
Okay, sounds reasonable.
The ESA's demand was that nothing be done because letting people have remote access to games would be a unacceptable infringement of their copyright.
According to its website, software copyright is the application of copyright in law to machines, readable software. While many of the legal principles are policy debates concerning software copyright have close parallels in other domains of copyright law, there are a number of distinctive issues that arise with software. These are focus on the topics partly of software.
Did you catch any of that, Professor?
I did.
Oh, good. I kind of did. I just went, yeah, this legal jargon is going over my head.
I think there might be a concern to the licensing of the games in relation to the archiving them into the thing, because when it comes to game development or software development in general, you need to get licensing agreements between companies and lawyers and whatnot.
Yeah, but that's not a problem for movies. The Library of Congress archives movies as well.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Do they archive movies as unedited form or edited form? Because, like, just to avoid the copyright, like, sometimes, let's say, for example, if they archive Rebel with a Cause and they have a certain song in that thing that's not copyright, over-edited in the new edition. So is that going to, which one?
I believe they preserve the original release.
Okay.
There also could be a relation that possible aesthetic to it is that historically, computer programs were not effectively protected by copyright because they were not seen as fixed, tangible objects.
Yeah, that is an argument that's been made in the past.
I agree with you there, Professor, but I think that argument is going to be blown away with VR, I reckon.
What?
I reckon with the introduction of VR, that video games will the whole concept of it's not tangible can be that argument can take it can be blown away by it. Like, you can't physically, I get it, you can't physically touch it, but when you use virtual reality, like, you could sort of touch it in essence.
Still can't touch it. You're still only touching the hardware.
I
think it was Stallman who said that you shouldn't have to pay for software because you can't touch it.
It also could be with the rule of doubt under the copyright certificates by the Copyright Office.
It seems like the ESA's argument, if I get this right, it's basically trying to avoid piracy becoming a thing. That's what the ESA is trying to justify, is it not? Or am I reading it wrong?
I think you're getting along the right lines, but I think realistically, if that was a problem, then we'd have a problem with libraries. And yes, there are people out there who have problems with libraries, but they're generally regarded as idiots.
How so?
Well, have you ever seen someone trying to shut down libraries be taken seriously?
Not that I know of.
Yeah, in relation to the rule of doubt under the US copyright law. So I don't know if that is associated with Australia. I couldn't find anything in Australia. Mm. But it says they're saying we will let you deposit object code, but since we can't read or understand it, we won't commit ourselves as to its copyrightability, which is in relation to so that could be a thing. If the registration is accomplished under the rule of doubt, the copyright owner may be unable to claim the presumption of ownership.
Hold on, so the copyright office was saying you can't copyright it because we don't understand it.
Yep, and we won't commit ourselves as to its copyrightability. If the registration is accomplished under the rule of doubt, the copyright owner may be unable to claim the presumption of ownership.
Okay, that must be a very old ruling, because I'm pretty sure you can be sued for copyright infringement for downloading pirated software.
Hmm, that may be right. It is the internet. There's a lot of old stuff on it. But it could be linked to why there's such a debate going on between this, but for this discussion about
I think before 2000 copyright of software wasn't taken as seriously.
How long you reckon before we start getting games with the before the game starts you get ads like you wouldn't download a game, piracy is bad.
Funnily enough, that was already a thing.
Yep.
Really?
Yeah.
There were some TV ads about that situation as well.
Well, there wasn't an ad like a video, but I'm pretty sure it was the original Doom had a message when you installed it saying, "Thanks for buying this game. If you didn't pay for it, you stole it."
Oh, really? Ah, nuts.
Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking about. Yeah, piracy is a crime.
Piracy.
Oh, that ad.
I love the IT Crowd parody of that.
Oh, yeah.
The whole, you wouldn't shoot a policeman and steal his helmet and do a poo in the helmet and send it to his wife.
Some gangs like, though.
Yeah, that was actually funny, that scene. So what does it... So, okay, that being said, jokes aside, what does this mean for game preservation in the long run?
It's not good.
Yeah.
Will this affect also Ross Scott's case as well with his crusade against game preservation?
It could, though. It could be, but I'm not following the case. You may have to enlighten.
So,
well, Ross has already said the US is a lost cause. I don't think it will have any effect. Mm. He's targeting countries that actually have consumer rights. Sorry, America. I found the Doom piracy warning. It says you are playing the ultimate Doom. If you haven't paid for Doom, you are playing illegally. That means you owe us money. Of course, a guy like you probably owes a lot of people money. Your friends, maybe even your parents. Stop being a freeloader and register Doom.
Wow.
This is the first Doom, right? Not the new Doom.
Yeah.
Not the oh shit.
Wow.
It reminds me of South Park with there's that scene where they download, it's about illegally downloading music, and someone goes, "Oh, it's just a song," and the police officer goes, "Not a bad problem, huh?" And he takes him on a tour like of all these rappers, like Big Puff Daddy here. He's supposed to get a nice nice mink coat, but thanks to piracy, he will never get that mink coat, or something along those lines.
South Bank knows how to hit the social the problems that exist with all and make that tire out. Also,
but you reckon
the same thing?
Yeah, but you reckon with the with the gaming with this preservation, you reckon you'll see a lot of bootleg sites coming back up again?
No, they've been pretty heavily hit in the last couple of years.
Yeah, they wouldn't. Nah, thing is, just people who own the games will back it up.
Which, as I understand, under the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it's not illegal to back up a copy of a game you own. It's illegal to share it around.
Yeah, I'm seeing some of the people have been responding to this ruling, saying that some have been upset by this decision. One lawyer argued the ESA has been unwilling to meet researchers and preservists halfway, and any changes are made or proposed, they said, will never be enough for rights holders of these games. It underlines how deeply touched they are about the games as a medium. And one of the quotes, harming scholarship and teaching because there might be an interest in recreational play doesn't feel fair to them, which puts a lot of effort into making these works available. You can see the, and there's apparently a stream about this.
Not surprise me.
And a transcript.
I'm pretty sure everything's on Twitch these days.
Yeah. Everything is.
We'll put the links on the show notes for anyone that's interested in this.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
So, moving on. What are they using Rotten Tomatoes for, DJ?
Okay, so a new report has come out saying that Rotten Tomatoes are becoming increasingly important to directors in getting more jobs, according to The Hollywood Reporter. This was from a director representative who was interviewed for the piece, shared their opinions that critical acclaim is now gamified. And this was revealed that the Rotten Tomatoes scores for previous directors' work are a go-to source for producers directing, deciding who to hire, and it inevitably affects decision-making. And the executive rebuttal supports this claim, but seemingly defends this process, sharing that when picking a director, all you have is their past work and a meeting. So
they're using reviews to choose which director to hire.
Yeah, yeah. Here's the thing. On face value, it sounds like a good idea, okay? Yeah, you have your Rotten Tomatoes scores that highlight your success, how big of a successful director you are. But here is the problem with this. Rotten Tomatoes is infamous for a lot of things, such as manipulating review scores, to censoring opinions on it, for example. So, I mean, on face value, sure, a Rotten Tomatoes score is a good barometer of a director's success, but when you have Rotten Tomatoes, it kind of like, And not to mention, the other problem is, like, which scores do you follow? Do you follow the actual movie critics' scores who you know for a fact that they're mainly bought by studios? Or do you go with the audience scores, who most of the times are just, who haven't seen the film and just written an angry comment out of spite?
Yeah, like, I think, like, trusting reviews in relation to hiring directors is a terrible idea, because though some directors, like every director, has hits and misses, and sometimes they have more misses than hits, but doesn't mean that the hits were lower than anyone else's. Like, look at like good example was watching Tim Burton. He had a lot of failed movies throughout his career, mostly in relation to Disney. They didn't know what to do with him, but in the end, some of his movies won rewards or are some of the best films out there for followers in that type of genre.
Like, I get that, like, some of the big directors, you like Tim Burton, like your example, Tim Burton, for example, it's a good, he has some hits and misses, but the awards, like, that come with him. But then you've got other directors that haven't really, they've made like just one movie, and then they get picked for a big budget movie. Like, for example, Chloe Zhao in the Eternals for the Eternals movie. She's only famous for that one movie, and that was a movie. I think it was called Out. I don't know what it was, what the title of it essentially exactly was called, but it was a movie about nomad life, Nomad Land. That's the. But I think it, I personally think it's on face value, it's a good idea, it, just to see the like is this director well received and whatnot. But you're right, like there are some, it's a bad idea. On the other hand,
yeah, like it's like I'm taking on the role of, like, the devil's advocate here. Like you say, it can give them an idea of what the director's thought process is. But on the other hand, there's not always the director who does it. They look into the writers, the producers, and everything else when it comes to a movie or a TV show.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not the director's fault, because there's not a mesh between the writers and the actors and whatnot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And relying on things like Rotten Tomatoes or any other, I guess, review website, even like YouTube reviewers, you have to take it really at face value, because it's just people's opinions and not something you should clearly rely on, make your own opinion, or you're not going to do anything worthwhile.
The article also shows out, points out the several issues inherent to using Rotten Tomatoes. The first of it is the demographic diversity of the critics hired at publications that are included in the Rotten Tomatoes aggregator do not always reflect the diversity of audiences interested in the particular title. So basically saying that critics are not the entire population of moviegoers.
They're like they're the minority, you know.
Yeah. Another issue, among many others, is the fact that 50% score, which is deemed rotten, still means a movie was enjoyed by half the critics who watched it. A gray area that isn't accurately reflected by the splat the title receives. But I went to the Hollywood Reporter article that they were talking about, and some of the stuff they were saying. In a second. Some say that insiders say that non-writing directors are having a particularly difficult time because of the limited number of studio films opening director assignments that would normally be within the grasp of younger filmmakers are going to higher level talent. Elsewhere, up-and-coming directors, those who have a festival movie or two under their belts, are looking for the next step up, are getting boxed out. Long gone are the days of Colin Trevorrow making the jump from Sundance Darling to Jurassic World, which is true. Yeah,
because like if they're like things that mostly go on to those things are your big feature films, more or less. Not many indie, and some of those indie directors and indie films in general are so much better than the Hollywood big shots out there.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not a good thing. Like I just say you'd go into you want to meet the director, talk about what they have a vision for the film, look into their own works, and like have a unanimous decision on where the thing to go, so everyone in the parties.
I did also look at the quote, by the way, that they said the critical acclaim is now gamified using the Rotten Tomatoes scores. And the an example they posted was directors unable to find work in the studio system can seek refuge in the prestigious TV. Post Birds of Prey, a 2020 film, director Cathy Yan landed episodes of the HBO series Succession, netting her an Emmy nomination. Still episodic work will only get you far. Offers one process of studio films. When you get handed the keys to a Ferrari and you run it, drive it a few blocks without crashing, no one cheers for you. And directors can write themselves out of presumed jail, packaging independent directorial efforts. Of course, producer finances with lack indie efforts are facing financial headwinds in 2024. Last year is announced Yan will direct this indie sci-fi love story, The Freshening, of a movie that she wrote. Disgruntled filmmakers and reps point out that directors such as Robert Zemeckis, who hit a massive run of films in the 90s and in the aughts, but has yet to deliver a financial hit in the past decade, but nonetheless gets a studio green light. Welcome to Marwen, his recent theatrical release, grossed $13 million on a $39 million budget.
Well, that's just looking back at his past works and that. But that his over the time, his vision could have changed, and he doesn't want to go into that direction anymore. Directors are human too.
Yeah. So the people that spoke to the reporter for this story, from filmmakers to reps, they also note the perilous state of the studio feature and filmmaker fallout are likely to be disproportionately affecting female directors and filmmakers of color, as Movie Jail often has. In 2023, out of the 116 directors evaluated in 2023, 12.1% were women, according to USC's Annenberg Inclusion Initiative. And as so far in 2024, top 25 grossing films released so far this year, three were directed or co-directed by women. That's a very, very interesting figure.
How so? It's just directors doing director stuff, I don't accept.
Yeah, I get that. But then it's just like Hollywood keeps on talking about how, okay, we need to get more like female directors and female filmmakers and like get the diversity going in Hollywood. Yet you're seeing this number falling, like a low number of people achieving success.
Well, this could be because they're not good directors in general. It's just...
Yeah.
It's just that it's more reliant on like their level of talent and skill or their visions that they want to portray, but like Hollywood or other the big movie development companies, organizations say, just don't feel that type of thing that works with their brand, I say with quotation marks in the air.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think the whole measure of using Rotten Tomatoes, as I said earlier, the whole using Rotten Tomatoes, on face value, it's a nice idea, but when you try and apply it, apply more into it, it's a tough ride. It's a tough situation.
Yeah, like short term, it gives you a highlight of what they're, as I said before, like it's the highlight of what the directors are they're doing. But in the long run, it's not a good choice for data selection or gathering data, because it is public domain, Rotten Tomatoes. So those people just, as you said before, to your point, just writing hate because they themselves hate the film. Or they're just trolling.
Yeah.
It's the internet. Trolls exist everywhere.
Yeah. And like I said, and as I said earlier, like Rotten Tomatoes has its history of being a dodgy site as well, like how they manipulate scores and whatnot. So like I wouldn't heavily trust Rotten Tomatoes as a go-to, but at the same time, like, you know, you kind of have to find another site, maybe Metacritic, for example, or someone else, essentially.
But again, they're all public domain as
well. Yeah, yeah.
Dispatches.
Yeah, and not to mention as well, like, which critics would you trust? Would you trust the actual critics, people who work in access journalism, or would you trust the fans of the films, for example? It's a balancing act.
It's the ideology of too many cooks in the pot, so to speak.
Yeah. Professor, you've been really, really quiet. What have you got to say?
No, I'm not sure I have anything to add. I think it's a not particularly good metric, and that it's too easy to game. And surely a better metric would be the amount of return on investment that a director made on their previous project.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
But that might be complicated by the Hollywood accounting.
Corruption.
Yeah. Hollywood accounting. Oh, who could forget that?
So let's move it along. For our shout out this week, we have the 10th anniversary of the movie Ex Machina. Written and directed by Alex Garland in his directorial debut, the movie was inspired by his childhood programming on a computer his parents bought him, which he felt had a mind of its own. He was also inspired by discussions with a friend with expertise in neuroscience who claimed machines could never become sentient.
Well, when it comes to sentience, that is not far away.
I guess he never found out about ChatGPT.
Well, ChatGPT's only been around for like a year, and this movie's 10 years old, so I wouldn't be surprised that he's never heard of ChatGPT. And the title is derived from the Greek Latin phrase Deus Ex Machina, meaning God from the machine, a phrase originating in Greek tragedies, where an actor playing a god would be lowered down by a platform and solve the character's issues.
Huh.
Yep.
Okay. Although it's interesting, I put an interesting factoid where all the names of the characters have a biblical name. Like Ava, for example, is the form of Eve, the first woman. Nathan was the prophet of in the court of David, and Caleb was the spy sent by Moses to evaluate the promised land. It kind of matches in a sense.
Ah, the Old Testament full of and contradictions.
Yeah, well, we could talk for weeks about the Bible.
That's another topic we can talk about.
Yeah. And we're running out of time. So our other shout out is the 70th anniversary of The Seven Samurai, a Kurosawa action film. It follows the story of a village of desperate farmers who hire samurai to combat bandits who have been stealing their crops.
Just looking at the cover, and I'm like, yep, that's 1950s.
Yeah, it's not a particularly good cover.
It's like a scrapbook.
The thing with Akira Kurosawa movies is that they are long. Great movies, but long.
You're talking, what, 2 hours, 3 hours?
Yep.
Sounds like the extended edition of Lord of the Rings.
The original idea for the film was to be about a day in the life of a samurai, beginning with him rising from bed and ending with him making some mistake that required him to go home and commit suicide to save face.
Wow.
That escalated quickly.
That really did escalate. Like, wow, yeah. Like, oh, I wake up, I eat breakfast, I go to the master's castle, and I screw up, I die. Yay.
Imagine the pacing of that movie.
Probably would have been pretty slow, since he did say that he does long movies.
Yep.
Just building up every bite, like ASMR of every bite of breakfast or something. But yeah, his movies are great.
A bit unique.
Yep. And unique eventually, is what Hollywood needs.
Eventually, when they decided on the existing plot, they wrote a dossier for every character with a speaking role, with details about what they wore, their favorite food, their past history, their speaking habits, their reaction to battle, and every other detail Kurosawa could think of.
Damn.
And he also created a family tree of all 101 residents of the village.
Jeez, design his own world. I respect that.
Yeah. This puts George R. R. Martin into shape.
And we also passed the 70th anniversary of the first practical solar cell, as demonstrated by Bell Telephone Laboratories. Solar cells were first invented more than 100 years ago, but were too inefficient to be of much use, when French physicist Alexandre Edmond Becquerel, son of physicist Antoine César Becquerel and father of physicist Henri Becquerel, you might recognize some of those names if you're into science, observed the photovoltaic effect in 1839, when working with metal electrodes in an electrolyte solution. In 1873, Willoughby Smith, an English engineer, discovered the photoconductivity of selenium while testing materials for underwater telegraph cables. In 1883, Charles Fritz made the first solar cells from selenium. He hoped that they would compete with Edison's coal-fired power plants, but were less than 1% efficient at converting sunlight to electricity.
Oh, we're moving towards the green energy ideology, so maybe they should go back and give this guy a bit more look into it and see if they can remake his ideas and make it more modernized.
Yeah, there's a lot of research at the moment into even more efficient solar cells.
The question will be, who's going to be the front runner in that technology?
No, it's not going to be America.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, China's got the manufacturing pretty
China's
locked down.
Got the, yeah.
Either China or India. That's my bet.
Oh, we'll see. Let the green energy race begin, so to speak.
And DJ, what is the messed up moment for this week?
So, in our messed up moments in nerddom number 11, I got a question for you. Have you ever seen The Wizard of Oz?
Which one?
Who hasn't?
The very popular one. The one with Judy Garland.
You mean the original?
Yes, the original.
Yes, I think everyone's seen The Wizard of Oz.
Okay, so I got a question for you. How did the Tin Man get his silver look, per se?
Didn't they paint it onto him?
Yeah, they painted on. So they did paint it. They painted on him. But there's a messed up moment in that one. And the messed up part is the paint that they used for painting him contained aluminium paste. And this aluminium paste was a problem when it gets to your eyes, and it would cause an infection. Now, the guy playing the Tin Man was the second actor after the original actor for the Tin Man dropped out of the project after realizing that the makeup that he used for his rendition, which is aluminium powder, was slowly killing him. It triggered a congenital bronchiarthral condition that made him very, very, very ill and led him to be hospitalized and therefore unable to continue shooting.
And you think the director would learn from that?
The makeup for the second actor was old. Yep. Oh, sorry.
This wasn't exactly a movie known for caring about the actors.
This is true.
although, mind you, when they tried the second actor, they altered the makeup, but it still didn't stop him from enduring the eye infection that forced him to undergo surgical treatment. So they kind of cared, but they didn't care. Didn't care enough.
So they didn't care at all. Like, oh, look, someone's sick. Get another one. We can replace them.
I remember Mythbusters did an episode about painting someone entirely in paint and whether that would be enough to kill them, based on the Goldfinger scene. Mm. But they also covered the Wizard of Oz incident as well.
Or it depends on what's in the paint. If it's got like aluminium powder, or if it has a lot of lead in it, that both end up in a bad way.
Yeah, I got the video here. It's one of the Mythbusters, Carrie, was covered in silver, painted silver from head to toe.
Yeah, then they redid it with Adam, I think.
Oh, yeah.
A few years later. So, yeah, a wacky movie for this week.
Sorry, BPM. What was that?
Didn't the Mythbusters learn anything from the situation with the actual movie by paying someone in that ends up killing them or getting them very sick?
Well, fortunately, nobody was harmed.
Or so they.
So our wacky movie for this week is The Planet of the Apes, which on the 25th of April 1968 premiered in France. This is the famously parodied movie where an astronaut crash lands on a planet in the distant future where talking apes are the dominant species. Plot twist, it was Earth all along.
Ah, oh, there goes that spoiler.
Well, so what, he got thrown back in the future or thrown into the future? I think it's what ended up.
The far future.
Yeah.
Because when he comes back to Earth, he finds the ruins of New York. One of the original scripts was written by Twilight Zone creator Rod Serling, who was rejected for writing about a society that was too advanced or would be too expensive to film.
But the Twilight Zone writers were great.
Yeah, and they retained the twist ending, which was Serling's idea.
It was Earth.
It was actually also well liked by Charlton Heston as well.
And I never knew this, but it was based on a movie. Based on a book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most movies have links to books or paperbacks, so to speak.
I've pulled up a Wikipedia page for that, and it says that a couple were sailing alone in space when they find a manuscript from a floating bottle. I'm not sure that's how space works, but go on. And reading the synopsis, it's quite different from the movie, so I won't spoil the twist of this one.
What? It is Earth all. It's got everyone remembers the classic line from that movie at the end of it, the madhouse.
That wasn't the line. It was this line. Oh my God, you blew it up. You maniacs, you blew it up.
So they built a half-scale papier-mâché model of the Statue of Liberty for the ending. The actors playing apes were forced to keep their makeup on in between takes and had to drink everything through a straw, so their food was liquefied.
Why would they not let them take off their mask at least?
Because it took so long to do the makeup to begin with.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah, Hollywood makeup now, it's not like Hollywood makeup back then.
Practical effects are always better effects in most occasions, or a combination of both, as long as the CGI isn't terrible.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently Charlton Heston had the flu during filming, but they decided the sound of his voice added something to his character.
Must have got some ideas from Kubrick. because he always he made everything like for one of what I think it was one of the well I don't watch which movie it was, but he came to the actors and said, like, I want you to actually hit him this fight scene.
With Charlton Heston, apparently he not only encountered the flu, but he encountered the flu during a very, very hot day as well. Like, can you imagine having a flu in the middle of an Arizona heat? And you got also got actors in ape makeup who spend half the film, which Charlton have to spend half the film half naked, being brutalized by the elements and the actors in ape outfits. And Heston later on in the biography goes, even rubber rocks hurt.
Understandable. That's pretty extreme. If they got paid for all their trouble, a proper amount. But then again, it's
hard counting. Yeah. Charlton Heston notes, even rubber rocks hurt. And an interesting bit of guerrilla marketing, they hired journalists to play some of the extras to make sure the journalists would want to write about the movie.
Wow. That's
what
that's
would they write? Okay, what
manipulative and clever.
What would they write about though? Like, day one, I've been hired by the director to play as a gorilla in this movie. I hope it turns out well.
Maybe, but it does give the people insight into day to day life of the actor. So that could have been a play, so people actually go and see the film.
Yeah, I guess, but then you also have to take into account, like, they will also say, like, oh, the sets were not done right, there was so many director cut corners, and blah, blah, blah. Like, you'll have to take that into account.
Unless they get paid off.
Yeah, that too, yeah.
Well, that's all we have for tonight. Where can they find us, DJ?
They can find us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Spotify, any other platforms we'll be under, and that's not canon.com, where we're an archive of our old episodes. Oh, and before we sign off, I want to give a congratulations to Comics to Movies for their recent achievement. It's a very, very mighty achievement they've accomplished. So they said it's been 10 years since the release of their first issue of XCT, so nice one.
Keep up the good work.
All right. Look after yourself, stay hydrated, and we'll see you next week.
Stay happy, stay nerdy. See you guys around.
Peace.
Here we go.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.